It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Coming up later, we'll take a look at the economic impact of low gas prices. First, there's still time to grab a great book as a last-minute gift for someone on your list or maybe for yourself. And our next guest is here to help. Maureen Corrigan is a book critic for Public Radio's Fresh Air and an English professor and critic in residence at Georgetown University. She says the list this year isn't about big buzz or big size, but about great books in smallish packages. Maureen Corrigan joins us now. Maureen, it's great to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Veronica.
Well, there were some heavy hitters with books out this year, names like Jonathan Franzen, and there were also just some pretty heavy books. City of Fire, I guess, clocked in at 900 pages. But those
yes.
weren't the books that made your list this year. Why not?
They weren't. I read both Purity and City on Fire, and I have to say that, you know, if I'm going to read 900 pages of a novel, it's really got to be spectacular. And I sound kind of snide there. I don't mean to dismiss Garth Risk Hallberg's achievement, but it's just not intense enough. It's not a spectacular enough reading experience to justify those 900 pages.
Well, what are you looking for when you make your best of the year picks?
You know, when I sit down at the end of a year and think back about all the books that I've read this year, I really want to think about the books that have stayed with me since I read them, maybe back in May or April, whatever. I also want to think about books that have taken me to a different place or made me think differently about things, that have just been innovative even in terms of their language and structure and characters. So a lot of books on my list this year are not the expected titles. And certainly even the books, as you just said, that generated a big buzz, like Go Set a Watchman, I've would rather forget rather than remember. But a lot of my books are memoirs, short story collections, one nonfiction history, and then a few novels that are really spectacular.
Well, all in all, would you consider the year 2015 a good year for books and readers?
I think it was a very good year for books. I think, once again, that as sometimes happens, the books that everybody expected to just, you know, sweep the reviews and be just outstanding in terms of sales and readers' response, that some of those books were disappointing, whereas others came to the fore.
Well, you said short story collections in particular rose to the top for you. What did you like this year?
Yeah, I loved Anthony Mara's The Czar of Love and Techno, which is a tough title. But, you know, Mara is a young writer who really broke out with this 2013 novel, A Constellation of Vital Phenomena. And this collection I like even better. They're interrelated stories. They start out in the Soviet Union in the 1930s with a character whose job it is to erase the images of dissidents from official photographs and portraits. And his brother is one of those dissidents. So this main character, Roman, sneakily starts inserting pictures, images of his brother behind Stalin, you know, into all of these official photographs. What's wonderful about Mara is his language is just ingenious. He creates characters who breathe. And these stories are linked. So we start out in the 1930s and we go up into the present through the device of some of these photographs and paintings that Roman has tinkered with.
So there's one short story collection, and there was another here that you liked.
Oh, a couple. Honeydew by Edith Perlman is fabulous. For readers out there who love, say, Barbara Pym, Lori Colwyn, these women who, you know, they just create worlds with their novels, with their short stories, mostly centered on women. I think of Edith Perlman as a luscious writer, and she's won so many awards for her short stories. One of the short stories that I particularly liked was called Assisted Living, about a woman who owns a resale shop, resale clothing and jewelry. And she sort of catches on that this shop has become something of a second home for two elderly, wealthy people who hang out there all day. One of the quotes that I used in a review of Honeydew for an earlier review for Fresh Air, I loved the way Perlman describes this elderly woman's voice. Her name is Muffy. It was as if Muffy had once been almost smothered and then allowed to live only if she'd limited her vocabulary and breathed hardly at all. I don't know. I've met women like that, you know. And I thought, yes. And I love Perlman because she's funny, too. I love writers who have that sort of wry sense of the world. The other short story collection that's a knockout and that is on so many people's lists this season is Lucia Berlin's A Manual for Cleaning Women. Berlin wrote short stories for much of her life, but she also worked as a cleaning woman. She worked as a switchboard operator. She worked in hospitals, you know, as kind of nursing assistants. She had those pink collar jobs that she writes about, but her stories are more than just sociology. They really bring to life these characters who are sort of on the fringe, trying to get by, and just because of their almost outsider status, they've got a really unusual take on work and on their fellow co-workers. They're terrific stories.
We're talking about the best books of 2015 with Maureen Corrigan. She's the book critic for Public Radio's Fresh Air and an English professor, critic in residence at Georgetown University. And, you know, we mentioned these short story collections, and some people just love short stories because they can take them in quickly. Other people really want to sink into a novel. So if you're not used to reading short stories, are these going to be accessible to you? Will you like them?
Oh, yeah, yeah. First of all, despite that title, The Czar of Love and Techno, which if I had been Mara's editor, nobody asked me, I would have said find another title because I find that off-putting. It almost is like a novel because the stories are interconnected. So you have the best of both worlds. You can read the discrete short story one at a time, but then you also have that sense of getting this panoramic view of life in the Soviet Union from the 1930s to the present. And Mara is also a writer who's got a wry sense of humor. So this really isn't a call to duty. It's a pleasure to read his writing.
So what if you just don't want to, you're not in the mood for a short story, even if it's linked, you want to sink into a novel, maybe a memoir. What about longer form stuff?
Oh, lots of great longer form stuff. Another book that's on everybody's list that I loved is a memoir called H is for Hawk by Helen MacDonald. If just listening to what this memoir is about, if I were a listener just hearing this and I heard me on the radio say, this is a memoir about a woman in Britain whose father died unexpectedly, and to overcome her grief, Helen MacDonald, the memoirist, decides to train a goshawk, a bird of prey, as a way of overcoming her depression over her father's death. I'd say, thanks, but no thanks. I have to tell you, I started reading this memoir, and it really felt like I was entering the Bronte's world. It's that same sense of you're out there in the wild with these people, and Helen MacDonald first and foremost among them, who just have a different way of coping, of seeing the world. I could care less about goshawks, but by page two, she sucked me in. So that's one that's really a standout.
That one surprised me. I started reading that as well. I'm not all the way through it yet, but it surprised me in that for the memoir genre, which I guess it falls under, it's surprisingly literary.
Yes, it is literary because she's also talking about literary representations of hawks, of these birds of prey, especially in the Camelot story. But she's not a writer who is so literary, who's so elite that you can't enter into her world. I mean, at bottom, what she's really talking about is dealing with grief, which is the subject of another memoir, Elizabeth Alexander's The Light of the World. Most people know Elizabeth Alexander because she read the poem at President Obama's first inauguration. She was the poet who read And her husband, who was an artist and a chef, Fikre Ghebreyesus was his name, died suddenly right after his 50th birthday. And this is a memoir, as much as it is about dealing with grief, it's also a celebration of a wonderful marriage. And she even includes recipes from her husband's restaurant, you know, to kind of just give you this sense of this full life that they live together. So I'm trying to sell it to people. I want people to be assured that it's not a downer in that sense. And I do also want to plug Bettyville, which is another memoir that sounds like it could be a downer, but is hysterical. Bettyville is a memoir by George Hodgman, who was an editor in New York, had a big career at Vanity Fair. And he moves back home to Missouri to take care of his 93-year-old mother, Betty. It's a little bit like Roz Chass' memoir of last year, Can't We Talk About Something Pleasant, More Pleasant. It's about the absurdity, the exhaustion, the totality of the experience of taking care of an elderly parent. And what's different in Hodgman's case is that he's gay, and that his mother and his late father never really acknowledged that he's gay. So here he is as a man, I guess, in his 50s, moving back home, moving into his childhood bedroom, and kind of falling back into the rut of this life that he lived as a child with his mother. And there's this big silence, you know, in the middle of this life that they're living together. I have given this book to three people I know who are dealing with caring for their elderly parents. I have a mother who's 96. This is a book to get you through. You will laugh. You will cry. It's a wonderful memoir.
And that one's called Bettyville. And Maureen Corrigan is with us right now. We're talking about the best books of 2015. Maureen is the book critic for Public Radio's Fresh Air and an English professor and critic in residence at Georgetown University. And we'd love to hear from you on this. What are your picks for the best books of 2015? Any surprises? Any disappointments? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page, and you'll also find Maureen Corrigan's list there of her picks if you'd like to refer back to that. On the first day of winter, it's prime reading time. We're taking stock of the best books of 2015 with Maureen Corrigan. She's the book critic for Public Radio's Fresh Air, and she's also an English professor and critic in residence at Georgetown University. And we'd love to hear from you on this. What couldn't you put down in the year 2015? And what book are you choosing if you're giving a book as a gift? What do you want to pass along to someone else because you loved it so much? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can also post your pick over on the Central Time Facebook page. And Maureen, I want to ask you, you've got one here about a dog. And this is one I have to tell you, which is prime on my list. I'm thinking about it for someone on my gift list. Tell us about this book about the World War II dog.
You know, talk about a book I can't stop thinking about, a story I can't stop thinking about since I first read it. It's called No Better Friend. And it's the story of Judy, who was a short-haired pointer who started out as a mascot on a British ship that was bombed during the evacuation of Shanghai. Judy went on to live for 3 years in a prisoner of war camp, a Japanese prisoner of war camp, with some of the men who she was with in Shanghai on that ship. And it is an incredible story. She's after the war, she was given, awards by the British government for courage. When she died, she was buried in an RAF flight jacket. Mm. I mean, I can barely talk about this story without tearing up. But she's the only dog who was officially recognized as a POW. And, I mean, the story is incredible. She's on two ships that were torpedoed. She survives both of those sinkings. She actually helps men who are injured in the water drags them to bits of debris. The story is written by Robert Weintraub, and it seems to be fairly, you know, well-sourced. He talks to men who are still around who remember Judy. He also, you know, has done his homework in terms of sources. And it's just, I kind of glibly called it the canine version of Unbroken, but it's one of those stories where you read it and you think, you know, there must be millions of stories like this where we have no idea what people went through. And this dog, according to some of the POWs who were in the camp with her, helped keep them alive. She sort of helped keep their spirits up, and she also helped keep them alive literally by going out at night and foraging and bringing back rats and other rodents that they would eat.
Yeah, that is an incredible story. It sounds like one that might even be for people who don't fancy themselves pet people, but who love history.
It's that great combination of a World War II story and, yeah, for those of us who are dog lovers, a great dog story.
Well, we had a caller who couldn't stay on the line with us who wanted to bring up the book Dear Committee Members this year. This is another one I've started and I'm not all the way through. I realize now that I have to finish reading some of these books. But what do you think about that one?
I love that one. I thought it was a hoot. It's structured out of a series of recommendation letters that a professor at a small college has to write. So what an achievement to, especially in this day and age, to have a novel constructed out of letters, an epistolary novel. And the letters are hysterical. For anybody out there who's a teacher who, like me, has to write a lot of recommendation letters, you will just eat this novel up because the voice is right in terms of how you structure these official letters. But the brilliance is that a story unfolds through the series of letters as well.
We've got a caller on the line now. We've got Susan joining us in Medford. Susan, hi.
Hi.
What is your vote?
It's a great book. It's called Ebola Safari, and it's about a nurse who was combating the Ebola epidemic in Sierra Leone last Christmas.
Oh, that's a very timely one. And what did you like about this one, Susan?
Oh, it's really great. It goes into just a lot of detail. It makes us feel like we're actually there. You get to meet different patients. And, you know, honestly, I mean, people always say this, but I laughed and I cried because it had kind of covered the whole gamut.
And who is it by? Do you have the author handy?
Sure, yeah. It's by Richard Mertens.
Okay, Richard Mertens, and it's called Ebola Safari.
Correct.
And I think, Maureen, that this one may be pretty recent. Have you read this one yet?
I have not read this one. My nightmare in coming on this show is that everybody's going to call up and give me titles, and I'll have to say, I haven't read that.
Well, you've read
There's
a lot.
So much out there.
Right, and this one is Mertens for the last name of the author, we just found out. So that sounds like an interesting one. So speaking of which, Maureen, how big is your backlog of books that you still want to read?
Oh, I always have books that I want to read that I, you know, by my nightstand that just sort of grows incrementally decade by decade. When you asked me if this was a good year for books, every year is a good year for books. Some years are, you know, you have more of the standouts than others, but we just have an abundance of amazing writers and great stories in every genre. So, none of us should ever be at a loss for what to read. It's almost like there's too much to read.
Well, for people who are still shopping, what about anything for young readers, maybe young adults?
Oh, gosh, that is not my strong suit, despite the fact of having a 17-year-old daughter. Certainly the YA fiction is its own world. And I just have to defer to our listeners. It's not the world that I really know very well.
Well, there is one that sounded like it could sort of straddle some of these genres, but be for adults. Kazuo Ishiguro has one called The Buried Giant.
Mm-hmm. Loved it. I love his work. I think he first came to everyone's notice with The Remains of the Day. And I don't think anybody anybody sort of writes about loss, kind of the twilight world of sort of looking backward and yearning for what's lost, better than Kazuo Ishiguro. He's also amazing because it seems like with every different new novel, he sort of dips his toes into a different genre. And this novel is, you could classify it as fantasy. It's set in the Middle Ages. It follows two pilgrims who are going through this fantastic long landscape looking for their long-lost son. And, you know, they take a lot of wrong turns. They meet a lot of fantastic characters. But I'm someone who doesn't usually gravitate toward fantasy. But in Ishiguro's hands, this is so moving. And he just had me all the way through the journey.
Oh, it's a good recommendation. Maureen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Maureen Corrigan. She's book critic for Public Radio's Fresh Air, and she's an English professor and critic in residence at Georgetown University. And her picks for the best books of 2015, that article is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'd love for you to weigh in. Tell us what you think, what books you're passing on to other people, what books that you couldn't put down this year. If you're planning on hitting the road this holiday season, you're in luck. Gas prices are the lowest they've been in a long time. The national average price for regular unleaded gasoline is hovering around $2 a gallon. And at many stations across Wisconsin, the price is even lower than that. For a lot of us, that means a few extra bucks in our pocket. It sounds like good news, but there are big questions about what this means for the national and the state economies. Steve Deller is here with us now to take a look at some of these questions. He's a professor of applied economics at UW-Madison. Steve, welcome back.
Good afternoon.
So gas prices down by about 60 cents from where they were last year. What's causing the low prices?
Well, it's basically Saudi Arabia. They have decided that they really want to preserve market share. And they can produce at $10 a barrel. So any price above $10 a barrel, they're making a profit. And they basically, you know, saw the tar sands coming online, the frack oil coming online, and they just decided that they didn't want the competition. So what do? They cut the prices.
Well, it seemed as though for a while, we were a few years ago embedded in this $3, $4 gas cycle. It seemed like that was here to stay. So it's been hovering quite low for a while now, longer than you might expect. So how long do you think this can last?
I think it's going to last at least a couple of years. You know, Saudi Arabia could keep the prices down for indefinitely. But eventually the prices will go back up. Will they go back up to $4 a gallon? Eventually they will, because, you know, the cheap oil, the ability to drill cheap oil is eventually going to go away. Now, whether that's in the next 10 years or the next 50 years, I don't know.
Go away because of clean technology?
Well, go away because they've simply tapped it out. You know, we have an excessive amount of oil. The question is, what is the cost of getting it out? The tar sands in Canada, for example, they have more oil in the tar sands than all of Saudi Arabia put together. The question is, how do you get it out of the ground without destroying the environment, and at what price?
Well, as we look at these low gas prices, the question is out there. Is this good for the economy? Obviously, if you're a consumer, you're buying gas, it feels like good news, but is it?
It depends. I think for the state of Wisconsin, it's probably a net gain because we're not really an oil-producing state. We don't really have a lot of big oil companies here. But if, you know, who's really taking it on the chin here within the U.S. context are the oil companies. They are, you know, they're not generating nearly as much money as they were before. If you have a 401k or some type of retirement fund, odds are you probably got oil stock in that fund, which means that you're being affected by that. Now, is that being offset by it not costing nearly as much money to fill up your car or your truck? Yes.
So you've got investments there. Are we also looking at layoffs at oil companies and maybe even possible companies going under?
Yeah, we are seeing that. I've been paying particular attention to the frac sand industry in the state of Wisconsin, and we're seeing a significant slowdown in that market. The bigger companies that have gotten into that are able to ride it out because they have the cash reserves. The problem is that the smaller companies are really kind of between a rock and a hard place here, because many of those smaller companies, in order to get up and running with those higher prices, took on a lot of debt. And with these lower prices, it's really difficult for them to cover that. So the big producers, they're going to come out fine. They can ride it out. The smaller producers, they're going to be in a world of hurt if this keeps going. I was just reading before I came over that there are still oil platforms that are still opening up in the U.S. And you would think that that's, you know, that doesn't make any sense. And what it is that these oil companies are basically, because they're between a rock and a hard place, they have to keep trying to keep the cash flow going, which means they have to keep drilling. The question is, how long can they sustain that? Saudi Arabia's idea is they don't want them around. So I think Saudi Arabia is going to try to keep the oil prices down, and it's going to squeeze these smaller producers out.
So Saudi is just waiting until they have more of a supply side squeeze and then prices go up?
Essentially. A lot of it's also going to depend on what the other oil exporting countries do, the Venezuelas of the world. You also have Iran coming online now. Some folks have speculated that that's why you've seen the drop in oil now, is that with the nuclear deal in Iran, Iranian oil is going to start coming out of the market. If we've already got a glut, then that's just going to make things worse.
We're talking to economist Steve Deller right now from UW-Madison, talking about the economic impact of low gas prices, as especially people thinking about driving during this holiday season. And Steve, you mentioned in general good news for Wisconsin, you said, but on the other hand, what about the economic impact to some of the towns in Wisconsin that might rely on the frac sand industry?
Some of these are, again, some of the bigger producers are going to continue to keep operating, at least for the short term. The smaller operators, the medium and smaller size operators, they're basically going into shutdown mode. They are generally small enough that they can't influence the market at all. So they're basically seeing the bottom of their market giving out. Some of them will continue to operate because they have to keep the cash flow going. They'll operate up until the minute they declare bankruptcy. And that will probably happen when the banks decide you got to pay your loans off.
And what about sustainable energy development? This is something, you know, we've seen the Paris talks and the president's emphasis on putting more into new technologies. Now, here we've got record low gas prices. Is that encouraging anybody to buy a fuel-efficient car or for a company to build it?
You know, that's a very interesting question. We have seen the demand for gasoline actually going down. And a lot of folks, well, that's because of the Great Recession. Well, no, it's going down because people are driving less. They're riding bicycles more. They're taking mass transit more. And they're buying more fuel-efficient cars. But unfortunately, the American consumer has a very short memory. And you're actually seeing SUV sales going back up. I think the auto industry knows that this is kind of a short-term type phenomenon. I would imagine that they are betting that they need to continue to produce more fuel-efficient and cleaner cars and SUVs and trucks. And the best way to get a cleaner car is to get better gas mileage.
What kind of planning do you think that we need to be doing for the price in oil going up? Eventually, as you say, it will eventually have to go up. What do we need to be doing to think about that?
It's inevitable. I would think that for your typical Wisconsin consumer, it all comes down to the price of gasoline. And I think that your typical consumer is going to continue to move towards more fuel-efficient cars and fuel-efficient trucks. You will still see the folks that buy the big gas guzzlers because that's what they like. Some of those folks will continue to buy even at $4 a gallon. So it's I think we're kind of seeing a short-term blip downward. I don't think we're going to see $4 a gallon for a while.
Now, when you talk about saving at the pump, you know, you've got consumers with more money in their pocket. One figure I saw was something like $550 on average a year in fuel savings for Americans. So you'd think, okay, that money's going to go back into the economy. It's going to give the economy a boost. Is it working out that way?
Well, I think for Wisconsin, it's going to work out that way because, again, we don't have many oil producers in the state of Wisconsin. So me spending $50 to fill up my car, I now spend $20 to fill up my car. That $30 difference, I'm going to spend it on a Wisconsin company as opposed to a big multinational corporation oil company, which that money goes out of the state. So there's a potential for Wisconsin to actually come out a little bit ahead on this one.
And what about nationally? Is that what we're seeing nationally?
Nationally, well, I'm glad I'm not in Oklahoma right now because they are really taking it on the chin because a lot of the Oklahoma and the Texas economy, not so the Texas, but Oklahoma and certain parts of Pennsylvania and the Dakotas, they're really not doing very well right now.
Well, this gets at issues of debt habits as well. I mean, we came out of the Great Recession, and Americans had racked up a lot of debt there. Are they interested, do you think, in putting more on a credit card, spending more again, loosening the wallet strings now? Or are there some frugal habits, do you think, that Americans have picked up?
I think it's both. I think we're going to see more frugalness in terms of the types of cars that we buy. But I think we're also going to say, oh, geez, you know, hey, that cash flow is going to make my life a little bit easier, particularly, I think, for the working poor, if I can call it that. These are folks that are making minimum wage, maybe a little bit above minimum wage, and they're dependent upon cars to get back and forth to work. Those lower-income folks, this is going to be a real help for them. For higher-income folks, it's pocket change, to be honest with you.
We're talking right now about the economic impact of low gas prices with economist Stephen Deller from UW-Madison. And we'd like to hear from you on this at 800-642-1234. Have low gas prices impacted your holiday travel plans? Do you find yourself maybe driving a little more often, or are you making different plans that avoid using the car, say? And what do you think these dollars are going to do when you're not spending them at the pump? Are you spending them elsewhere in the economy, or are you saving them? Are these prices good or maybe bad for the overall economy? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking right now about the economic impact of low gas prices with economist Steve Deller of UW-Madison. And prices at the pump way down, but what effect is that having on state and national economies? And we're trying to answer those questions right now, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have low gas prices changed your buying habits? Are you spending more? Maybe you're saving more. And do you think that these prices are overall good or bad for the economy? Call us at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we go to our callers now. We've got Jake on the line in Lancaster. Jake, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I'd just like to bring up the point. I work in the grain industry. And the low gas prices are having quite an adverse effect on our Wisconsin farmers. The low gas prices have driven the price of ethanol down fairly significantly and caused a lot of our local farmers that I work with to drop corn prices below their cost of production. And this is having a trickle-down effect on both the farmers, the implement dealers, seed companies, fertilizer companies, anybody related to the grain industry. Just like to hear your thoughts on how that is impacting the overall Wisconsin economy.
Jake, thanks so much. Appreciate you calling and bringing that up. Jake's saying ripple effects in the ethanol industry.
I think there's a couple of points that were raised, some of them very good points. And I think the ethanol industry is another one that is extremely sensitive to changes in the price of crude oil. We've seen this before with ethanol in the late 1970s and early 1980s, and I think we're seeing a repeat of it now. I think we're going to see a tremendous consolidation in the ethanol industry where the big guys, Archer Daniel Midland in particular, is buying up a lot of these smaller ethanol plants basically fire store prices. And some of the smaller ones, they're just simply shutting them down. And I think that is going to affect the demand for corn to some extent. Don't quote me on the price, but there's been some studies that have been done that suggested that corn prices are influenced by maybe a quarter or up to a third at the highest end on ethanol production. So you do see an impact there. I think the benefit to the lower oil prices is that diesel prices have been dropping. And also a lot of the fertilizers that are petroleum-based are going to be dropping as a result. So on the one hand, the farmers are seeing lower costs, but they're seeing less demand for corn in particular. The other thing is what drove a lot of the corn prices was foreign exports. So it's still going to see how it's going to play out. But if you're a farmer that's heavily dependent upon ethanol for selling, that's you're gonna take it on the chin on that one.
Great, Jake. Thanks so much for bringing that up. And we're going to go next to David in De Pere. Hi, David.
Well, good evening. How are you doing?
Good, thank you.
I'm an hourly worker, and I employ other hourly workers, and it is helping to have more cash at the end of the month. But an issue that concerns me is there was a huge controversy in our state when the governor couldn't come up with the money to build enough highways, and the legislature really struggled with that. With gas prices so low, shouldn't this be the time we raise the gas tax so we can maintain our infrastructure?
Another interesting point, David. Thanks for that. Steve, you may be familiar with us coming up a little short on transportation here in Wisconsin. What about this being the time?
From an economist's perspective, I think it's an excellent idea. The motor fuel tax is actually almost a user fee because who's using the roads? It's the people putting gas in their cars and trucks. I think the timing is perfect for it. Now, from a political perspective, I don't think it's going to it's not going to happen, period.
Mm. Why not?
Because the legislature and the governor's office will not support anything that's even close to raising taxes. What's been proposed now is that counties can actually opt for an additional local option sales tax and then take the proceeds from that, go from a 0.5% to a 0.5%, and take that proceeds to pay for local roads. And essentially what's happening is the legislature is essentially saying, you can raise taxes. We're not raising taxes. You're raising taxes and giving them that opportunity.
David, thanks a lot for that. And we're going to go to Joe calling from Wauwatosa. Joe, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. How about you?
I'm all right. My point has to do with the overall geopolitical situation, because there are a lot of tyrannical or tyrannical white type governments that are also a lot of oil, such as Saudi Arabia or Venezuela. And when you have lower oil prices, they've got less money to spend on, say, nefarious things. Like in Venezuela, they could use it to try to placate their people so they don't have to make real reforms economically. In Saudi Arabia, a lot of people there fund terrorism with their high oil prices. And so I realize that Saudi Arabia is trying to keep oil prices low to try to knock America out of their fracking economy. But I also think that could be beneficial in the long run, because if you look at ISIS in Saudi Arabia, that they fund terrorism and they use it to support terrorism, use it to support radical Islamism, that if there's less money to spend on that, that's a good thing.
Okay, Joe, thank you for that. Is there a national security benefit here, Stephen?
That's a complex one, because of the international oil markets are so complex and so vast. I heard one person speculate that one of the reasons that Russia is kind of thumping its chest right now and saber rattling is because they're trying to divert attention away from the fact that their economy is falling apart. And the reason their economy is falling apart is because they're dependent on oil exports. What's happened to the price of oil? It's dropped. What's happened to the Russian economy? It's falling apart. So let's distract the Russian populace by nationalist behavior. It's really, really complex. It's impossible to make a generalization one way or the other.
We're talking to Steve Deller right now, professor of applied economics at UW-Madison. He's talking about the impacts, small and large, near and far, about economic gas prices, about the low gas prices that we're seeing right now. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We're curious, are you driving more now that gas prices are down? Have you maybe changed your habits away from using as much gas? And what do you think about low gas prices and the economy here in Wisconsin and maybe beyond? Is it overall good, or is it bad if you look at the net gain or loss? And Steve, we haven't talked about air travel yet. A lot of people ready for airline fares to go down, but yet gas prices have been down for a while and that we haven't seen that happening. Why not?
Well, I think it's basically the airlines are taking in terms of profits. The airline industry is extremely competitive in the terms of you've got a couple of really big players. And what they're doing, I think, is they're basically waiting to see who's going to move first. You know, is Delta going to be the first one to start cutting prices? Is United going to be the first one to start cutting prices? And they're all in this wait-and-see mode. And in the meantime, they're basically profiting from these lower prices. Hopefully they take those profits and they reinvest it back into the airlines. But eventually you will start to see them come down. When? I'm not sure.
And you said they're in wait-and-see mode. What are they waiting for, per se, other than somebody moving? Is there a particular indicator that somebody's watching for?
It is. They are essentially waiting for their competitors to see what their competitors are doing. It's almost like a giant game of chicken.
But there's been no consumer outcry saying, hey, you know, oil prices are down. Why aren't we seeing airline fares coming down, too? Why aren't we seeing that?
Well, maybe we're starting that right now.
We'll see about that, huh? All right, we're going to go next to Russ in the Cedar. Russ, hi.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a Social Security recipient, and I've got a notice recently that we don't get a raise in Social Security this year because of the low oil prices.
Right. I've seen this, and we haven't talked about this yet, Russ. Thank you for bringing this up. And flat Social Security benefits attributable to the low gas prices. What do you make of that, Steve?
That's actually true. There's a lot of debate in terms of what is the right cost of living adjustment or inflation measure should you use. Traditionally, we have used the broad-based consumer price index, which includes food and energy. And a lot of folks have argued that we should really take food and energy out because it swings up and down so much, that we should use a more stable. So what you're arguing for, Russ, is that, you know, what economists have been arguing, that we should use the consumer price index that does not include energy and food.
Well, Russ, I appreciate you bringing that up. And Stephen, going forward, what are you going to be looking for in terms of the oil markets and gas prices and how it might, whatever happens, you think, how it's going to affect Wisconsin and the country?
I think we're going to see more consolidation in the industry. I think we're going to be seeing a lot of the smaller companies that came out when we had this boom in fracking. Not the tar sands so much, because only the big companies can get into that. But the smaller type operators, kind of the wildcatter type operators, I think we're going to see a lot of those guys, those firms, go away. They're simply not going to be able to ride this out. But that's kind of how the way that this industry operates. It's operated this way for years. It's almost like going back and it's rewatching what happened in the late 70s and early 80s. The exact same thing is happening. Technology's changed. But we're seeing the same type of swing in the industry.
And as far as the year 2016, prices staying low for this year at least?
I think they're going to stay low for a while. Will they be $2, below $2? I think it's going to probably stay below 2.25 throughout the year. I really don't see a reason that it will go up, but you never know. I mean, there could be a terrorist attack on one of the Saudi distribution points, and then all heck breaks loose.
Well, Steve, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Steve Deller, professor of applied economics at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about the economic impact of low gas prices.